JMV here with Brian Kahn from Floors to Your Home. Fans, if you're shopping for flooring of any kind, you need to check these guys out. You're going to have the most incredible, totally hassle-free shopping experience ever.
JMV, we really appreciate you saying that. That's our goal every day, to offer our customers a quick, easy, and hassle-free experience at all of our Floors to Your Home locations.
Fans, it works like this. You see the product you like, it's going to be cheaper than anywhere else, that's for sure. Then you can immediately take it home with you or have it installed.
That's right. No hassle, no special order. Just see it, buy it, and take it home or have it installed.
Like 3 rooms of hardwood, laminate, or waterproof flooring starting at just $349, and they have everything in stock. I'm doing my whole house, and believe me, this is the best shopping experience you'll ever have.
3 convenient locations, Avon, Noblesville, and Brookville Road.
Who gives the quickest, easiest, and most hassle-free buying experience?
Floors to Your Home. That's who.
From the Andy Moore Automotive Group hotline from Forbes Sporting News and more. He's staked out in Milwaukee. I'm assuming resting after watching the Bucks, especially in the first half, work over the Pacers last night in game number one. Evan Sidery is joining us now. Hello, Evan. How are you?
Doing great, John. Yeah, I could, like you just said, after the first 20 minutes of that game, I kind of was looking forward to something else after that. So it was a very much ugly game for the Pacers, but I think there's a multiple adjustments that they can make to maybe get this one back even.
All right, I want to talk about that, but bringing you on here, you probably heard Tyrese Halliburton from last night, what he said about, you know, their pace and their style of play. And Milwaukee, they didn't, especially in the first half, let them do any of that. And people argue that maybe they did in the third, but I still thought that it wasn't a good enough effort, not playing the style, the brand that they want to play offensively, which leads me to this. Are they able to, you think, strong-arm the Bucks and play their style, or are they going to have to try to win these grinding games, which I have zero confidence in them doing?
Yeah, I think it's going to have to be, like you just mentioned, John, Halliburton's got to get going again. He's got to get aggressive offensively. The ball's got to be moving faster on offense. And he's just got to be back to the player that we saw in December that was decimating the same Bucks team, even with Giannis on the court. And he was the best player on the floor in that game. He's just got to have that superstar type of switch flip back for him. And I think a lot of it was the Bucks were trapping him a lot yesterday. They were sending doubles his way. Obviously, the atmosphere up there was really fun, really crazy, too. A lot of inexperienced players, including Tyrese, on the Pacers roster, who haven't had any postseason experience. And you can kind of tell off the bat, like, Pascal Siakam was kind of the only guy that was really locked in from the get-go. And that really showed with 36 points there. But I think maybe, hopefully, you chalk it up to first-game jitters for a lot of these guys, including Halliburton. And you hope game two you roll around, do the same thing that guy here at this point, and ride Tyrese Halliburton. But one thing I will add, though, I think that the Pacers should continue doing that we saw from game one is feed Pascal Siakam. I think we're seeing now with the Bucks roster, the way it's constructed, with no Giannis in the court especially, they don't have anyone who can guard Siakam. Jay Crowder can't guard him. Middleton can't guard him. Especially Brooke Lopez can't guard him. I think that's something that they should continue doing is feeding Siakam. The Halliburton's got to get going again.
Yeah, and again, Evan Sidery joins us talking about game number one and adjustments that should be made for the Pacers when they get the Bucks in game number two coming up tomorrow night. You look at Halliburton, and clearly they're just trying to take away everything that he did to spark this team when they took 4 out of 5 from the Bucks over the course of the regular season. What are some of the things the Pacers can do, you think, to get him into gear outside of guys he's passing to make shots? Because the Bucks last night were just cool with basically everybody else trying to shoot it. They didn't really care too much.
Yeah, I think it's really going to be, if you're basing off Halliburton, you want to get him going. I've been a proponent of them doing this. I feel like they don't do it enough. I think they only do it on about 15% of their possessions. And that is running Pascal Siakam pick and roll with Tyrese Halliburton. I think with the way Siakam's playing, the way those two mesh together, it's pick your poison when those guys are running a pick and roll. And you can get Siakam rolling to the rim there, or Halliburton and a switch can get an easier matchup for himself to get a step back three, one of his patented moves, or get to the basket aggressively. I think they should run a lot more pick and roll, a lot more quick pick and roll, have those shooters like Ben Shepherd, especially Aaron Nesmith. Those guys got to wake up in game two and make their open shots because they looked like they were deer in headlights yesterday. and when the lights are shining brightest there. So it's going to be, I think, a lot of pick and roll and just hoping that those guys off those pick and rolls, those shooters, they make those shots, because I think that was just an abnormal shooting. I know it was a really bad night for the Pacers, but I'll be pretty stunned, honestly, if we see a worse shooting night than we saw last night from them.
You saw it there live, too, and you could tell watching it on TV, there was a high level of inspiration from the Bucks team without Giannis and being told that they're going to lose and, you know, what they were without their elite-level player. And then you add that with Damian Lillard, who has been an elite-level player, but you can tell where he thrives. And he was able in that first half to be the one-on-one guy that he really likes to be. And offensively, with 35 in the first half, that certainly responded. I was impressed with the way they came out and did that. That was a team of dudes that were inspired by a lot of things, and they showed that motivation.
Yeah, it was Damian Lillard, I think, leading the group on that. And the main thing to me was they just played, I think, pissed off. Like, the way that they played, it was, we're not going to take the Pacers crap anymore. We're going to go out there and kick them in the mouth in the first 5 minutes. We're going to let Damian Lillard take over this game and see what happens. And once he made his first couple shots and he started talking back to Halliburton, started talking to Nesmith on the court, you kind of knew at that point he got his swagger back, and he was vintage Damian Lillard, and that was kind of game over at that point, the first 10 or so minutes of that game. And you got to have a game plan to stop Damian Lillard, because at this point, especially with no Giannis Antetokounmpo out there for the next couple games, I imagine, you have to blitz Damian Lillard, you have to double Damian Lillard, really do what the Bucks are doing to Tyrese Halliburton, to Damian Lillard. I think that's really what has to happen on the defensive end here. And I think you got to stop putting TJ McConnell on him. I think that's a really bad matchup for a player like him. No more Doug McDermott minutes. I think that was kind of shown last night how bad he looked in his spots. You have to have elite defenders like Nesmith, Siakam, especially those two players, in my opinion. They got to take the challenge early on in this series and defend Damian Lillard.
Yeah, this whole Doug McDermott thing, I'm not going to make more out of it than it is, but you needed at least something when you traded Buddy Hield away before the trade deadline, and this is what you get in return. Hasn't helped. And I will also, I talked about this on Friday and then again today, clearly you miss Benedict Mathurin coming off the bench. Yep. Because he was big in those regular season games, but I mean, hell, last night you needed about five of him.
Yeah, and that's the thing with the situation. I also want to say, I don't think Rick Carlisle's best game last night either. I know the shooting was bad, but also trotting an 11-man rotation in a postseason game, especially in game one,
yeah.
I knew you were trying to find something, but this is the time where you run maybe eight or nine guys tops. You can't go 10, you can't go 11. And I think the teams that played 10-plus players in a rotation this week, they went 1-3 in those matchups. So that kind of just shows you a lot of those guys – they have their eight, nine-man rotation. You stick to them. You let those guys play through mistakes and let them ride their highs and lows. And that's kind of what the Pacers need to do here, is Rick Carlisle has to find two or three, maybe four guys at most off the bench that he trusts the most. And I think for me, it'd probably be, you'd have McConnell, you would have Obi Toppin off the bench, Jalen Smith, and then find your fourth one if you want to, maybe Ben Shepherd if you want to. But Shepherd did not look the part. He looked really nervous to me last night, at least. Like, the lights were too bright for him last night, and you hope that's just game one jitters for him. But you have to hope that group behind him really stands out. And like you mentioned, they're really missing Benedict Mathurin, but they're also really missing Buddy Hield and that gravity that he had on the offensive end, especially in those screen and rolls with Tyrese Halliburton to get him open space. And you're really missing those two guys right now.
Yeah, they were concerned. It's like other teams were when Buddy Hield was here. Regardless of if he's slumping or not, you're concerned where he is on the floor, and he's in constant movement. And there wasn't much of that concern. It was more concern about Halliburton, and then everybody else could do whatever the hell else everybody wanted, it seemed.
Yeah, it really, honestly, to me it was, don't let Halliburton do anything, and we're cool with Pascal Siakam getting 30, 40 points. As long as Halliburton doesn't join him in that fun, then we're fine with that. It's going to end up with a Bucks win, and that's what happened last night. I think that's kind of what the trend's going to be this series, John, is that they're going to let Siakam go off and have huge nights. I think he might have a 40-point game in this series because they can't guard him at all on the defensive end. But if Halliburton can't get back to 20, 24 points a game, 40-plus three-point percent shooter, I think they're in trouble. You definitely have to win game two tomorrow night. If you don't, you definitely have to win all two in Indiana. I think we talked in game one about how that's a must win, but especially now doubling down that you have to steal game two here. And if you give them momentum going back to Indiana, I would not be shocked at all. That could be like a backbreaking moment for this team in this series. You hope they respond, but if they get blown out again tomorrow night, that's some warning signs right there.
Is Evan Sidery talking NBA, specifically the Pacers and the Bucks first round series, game two tomorrow night from Milwaukee. He's on the Andy Moore Automotive Group hotline live from Milwaukee. So Rick Carlisle go with the 11-man rotation because he was searching for stuff. Obviously, they went 11 deep because he benched Jalen Smith. But was it more a search and find out if anything at all can work? Because certainly, as you mentioned, that's not the way he's going to handle it the rest of the way, right?
Yeah. There's no way that he's going to roll out a 10-11-man rotation, I think, the rest of the series. It's got to be 8 or 9. And like you mentioned, they got down so quickly in that game where 5-6 minutes into that game, Damian Lillard's making his shots and talking back to some Pacers players, and he knew it was over at that point. That lead was already 10, 15-plus points. It ballooned over 20, and that was game over. So I think you got to see an 8 or 9-man rotation. I think Carlisle, kind of we saw early on, most of that was in the first half when they were down by 15, 20-plus points. So it's probably just him trying to find an answer there, but you just have to hope that repeat story doesn't happen tomorrow and they get down early like that.
So Evan Sidery on the Andy Moore Automotive Group hotline. So what about Jalen Smith? We saw him get benched. Isaiah came in, didn't really do anything any better. So where are they with a backup big right now?
So this might be a little bit of a hot take, but I think the best way to go about attacking this Bucks team, especially with the way that their bigs are utilized, Brooke Lopez especially, I think this is a situation and a counter that the Pacers can run Pascal Siakam at a small ball center. You can put Obi Toppin at the four. You can put Nesmith out there too, Nembhard. I think it's really enticing to run that a heavy pick-and-roll system with Siakam as the five. You get Lopez away from the rim. He has that mismatch. Or if they want to go small and counter with them, I like the Pacers in that matchup too if they want to go small as well. So I think we see potentially I would run Pascal Siakam as the backup center to Miles Turner. Let Siakam play about 40 minutes per game and have him run it with the second unit as their small ball five and the second man center. So to me at this point, the way both those guys played last night and how huge tomorrow night's game is, I might cut both those guys out and just roll with Siakam as the backup.
So what do you do defensively here? What do you do with Lillard? The other part about this is, too, and I know that some people may disagree, but if you have Lopez and you put Miles on Lopez, Miles is always 10 feet from the basket, and guys so easily get around other guys no matter who we're talking about. Playing the Pacers defensively, how do you handle that?
Yeah, that's a tough one. I really think that it's going to have to be hope and pray that Dame has a cold night, and you just have to hope that there's a couple swing possessions early in that game where the Pacers can just get back momentum, just kind of show that they're in this series again, whether it's Aaron Nesmith or Andrew Nembhard kind of having a good defensive moment on Damian Lillard. I think it's got to be one of those guys is going to have to really step up and just kind of take the bull by the horns and win that one-on-one matchup. But if they want to double him, if they want to send traps, it's going to be you hope Chris Middleton doesn't beat you. But we've seen over the years Chris Middleton can't beat this Pacers team. But Middleton is definitely at a different stage of his career than we know from years past. So that's going to be an interesting counter to me is if you want to double and really aggressively attack Damian Lillard, it's going to be who guards Chris Middleton and how do you defend Chris Middleton. So I think it's going to be really interesting to see how the Pacers counter on that.
Yeah, I would agree with that too. I think that there's one thing that you can try to do, and that just seems like a really bad matchup. Even if Miles doesn't get to the ball, I mean, oftentimes guys will defer just because of his mere presence. But when you're when you're that far from the basket, whatever. And again, what are you going to do? The way they play defense, especially in the first half, it's not like anything I'm talking about right here is going to work.
Yeah, it was brutal. I mean, the atmosphere, I will say, first time in Milwaukee, so fun. The Pfizer Forum is a really awesome arena. And you can kind of tell walking into the arena and kind of hearing fans. It's kind of fun to say. I think it legit, John, is a rivalry between these two teams now. Because Bucks fans, they certainly, from what I was hearing in the crowd, they don't like the Pacers and they don't like the Pacers players. And I think this is a legit rivalry they're forming, which is cool to see.
No, I don't think there's any question. And I thought that you had a group of dudes that came out and basically played the way you just described. And then you had a Pacer team that already was without any experience doing that. And I thought that they were just simply out-toughed. I really hesitate to call professional athletes or athletes of any kind soft, but I thought that that was a soft approach coming out and playing the way that they did from the outset, buried them early. And I thought you saw a Bucks team that was motivated about a lot of things, especially hearing how they would win nothing without Giannis and the way the regular season went. They came out with a purpose, whereas the Pacers came out there scared.
Yeah, the Bucks rotation, John, is filled to the brim with postseason experience. Pacers, as we know, is not as much, but you could tell after that first kind of flurry from the Bucks when they're up by 15, 20 points, and the crowd's going crazy, and you kind of just look around at the Pacers players, and a lot of those guys, like Tyrese, for example, he just was like, oh, crap, like, this is the playoffs. Like, I don't think they realize like how hard the first punch is going to be by the Bucks, who have known what this postseason experience is like, what do-or-die situations are like, where a lot of this roster is in that situation where the Pacers got hit and it took them about 10, 15 minutes to recover there. And then at that point, it was too late. So I think they were kind of just thrown off guard by postseason basketball, which shouldn't be happening. But, I mean, that was, I think, my hypothesis to it all is that this Bucks team kind of was just pissed off and they just took it to them.
Evan, what's the latest word up there in Milwaukee regarding Giannis? It also, I would think, as long as they have success, why would you feel the need to bring him back unless you have to, right? So I'm assuming, you know, this is all going to push things back, maybe to a point to where if you really do need him later in the series, he reemerges. But right now, you probably don't have that need.
Yeah, I think it sounds like all indications he's doubtful again for tomorrow, so he's not going to play in game two. Game three is going to be interesting, especially how the Pacers respond tomorrow. I could see Giannis playing game three, but I have to imagine how good they played game one. And I think Giannis is the type of guy where if it's a game six or game seven, you can trust him to hold up for a game or two if necessary. I don't think we might see him until that point. If I had to guess, is that Damian Lillard and the Bucks looked so good to me last night where even without Giannis, John, I think this might go six or seven.
Yeah. I said six anyway. I tried so hard not to go off at the beginning of the show because you still have the opportunity tomorrow night to do exactly why you went up there, and that is the split this thing. But it is the way that they played, and I'm sorry, I didn't think this third quarter was some, you know, big savior of, oh, they're back in gear now, that's how they play. 29-14 is one thing, but I thought Milwaukee, it wasn't the Pacers' defense. I thought Milwaukee took their foot off the gas a lot in the second half.
Yeah. You could tell just by the energy in the crowd that everyone was kind of already celebrating the win, honestly, at halftime of that game. And everyone's saying that bring Boston, like, we're already ready for Boston, bring New York, like, all the Bucks fans around us were talking about like that. But I think to me, it's going to be a thing to me in the third quarter. That run was just the Bucks taking their foot off the gas, like you just mentioned there, John. I think it was just them kind of knowing this game was over. The Pacers counter with their adjustments at halftime. They went on their run there. And then we saw the Bucks kind of lock back in. And when it got to about 12-point game, the Bucks got it back up to around 20 when they had to lock back in when necessary. So I just think it was kind of just the ebbs and flows of the game where this game was already over and the Bucks kind of already knew that.
So what game, let's just say this thing goes seven, what do you think you see Giannis for the first time?
I would say, let's say it goes seven, and that's a good one. I would say that we do see him, I would say game six. If it gets to game six and the Bucks are, let's say, down in the series, for example, then we see, I think, Giannis play. If they're trying to close it out and they're up 3-2, I'd say they probably let it ride, and then maybe Giannis returns for game seven. I think it all kind of depends on how really tomorrow is going to set the tone for this entire series. If the Pacers lose that game tomorrow, I'm kind of worried this might be over in five.
Yeah, it was discouraging for a lot of reasons last night. It certainly was. And I always said Siakam to me was the only bright spot out there. That was it.
Yeah, it's the Pascal Siakam show to me, at least offensively, for them to Pacers to win this series. Obviously, Haliburton's got a rebound to his all-star form, but you ride Siakam, you can see no one's guarding him on this Bucks team. Let him get his 20, 25 shots. He'll put up around 30-plus points in that and just see where it gets you. It's going to be the Haliburton and Siakam show for the Pacers to win this one.
Yeah, you did notice, right, all these scores and how far down. I had the saying during the regular season that, you know, if you don't score 110, you're not going to win. And you don't see a lot of those robust scoring efforts thus far in the NBA postseason, which really concerns me more than anything else, how the Pacers are going to be able to grind one out, scoring at a lower pace against a good team with or without Giannis.
Yeah, I mean, we saw last night in the Thunder-Pelicans game, too, elite offenses that usually score in the 120s. That was a 96-94 final score where every possession, like you said, slowed it down, getting your sets about 7 seconds left. You get sun off about 2 seconds up from the clock. It's throwback basketball, but that's also postseason basketball. It's how it's going to be. The whistles tighten up. They're going to let you get away with some calls. How are the Pacers going to respond to that, honestly? We're going to find out the answer tomorrow to that. If they kind of get their doors blown off again in game two, then that's going to say a lot. But if they respond, it's a close loss, or potentially even, let's say they go out there and win that game and flip the series back to Indiana, then it's going to say a lot about their fortitude.
Hey, final thing with Evan Sidery here. Why did they, even in the third, when they made somewhat of a run, and I mentioned scored 29 in the third compared to the Bucks 14, and they got the ball out and was pushing it, why did they still look so clunky trying to run a break of any kind?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I think it's just I think the Bucks just had them thrown off, to be quite honest. I think they were just trying to get into their stuff, but the Bucks were so aggressive defensively, like they couldn't get into their stuff even early on. They had to wait and throw up some Hail Mary shots, or it was Pascal Siakam getting a switch and kind of attacking the guy in the mid-range. That was kind of the Pacers' whole offense last night. It's going to have to be how they adjust. I think it's going to be how Rick Carlisle responds, Tyrese Haliburton. It's those two guys. The guys that got you here, John, is how is the offense going to respond? How's the point guard? How's the all-star going to respond too? Because tomorrow's going to be a game where I think Tyrese Haliburton has to be like we saw in December against his Bucks team in the NCAA tournament. That's how they're going to be the rest of the series for them to win, to be honest. And Pascal Siakam continue to be Pascal Siakam. So I think it's on Haliburton, on Carlisle to make the right adjustments, but I think, to me, the Bucks really threw a huge haymaker, and the Pacers have to respond here.
I said this, and people say, well, he's getting double-teamed, and he's the focus, and the Bucks are trying to take him away. That's the territory that comes with being what you want him to be and what he's been talked about being a star in the NBA. That's the territory in which now you're going to have to navigate. So we can sit here and talk about what others have to do, but it is certainly what Tyrese Haliburton has to do, because that's where he's supposed to be. Thus, that's how you're going to be treated by other teams defensively, and you're just going to have to find a way.
Exactly. I mean, we already saw Damian Lillard when he gets defended like this during his Portland days. I mean, we're probably going to see the Pacers do it to him tomorrow night. Play two on them. Shai Gilgeous-Alexander with Oklahoma City, like we just mentioned last night, New Orleans running that same defense there. So Tyrese Haliburton's got to get used to it. He's got to respond. It's going to have to be also on the guys to help him get open space there, like Neesmith, like Ben Shepherd. These open shooters got to make those shots. And if they make those open threes, that's going to make defenders sag off of Haliburton naturally, maybe open up some more space for him there. So it's going to have to be a referendum on Haliburton and kind of the shooters here to help out with Pascal Siakam tomorrow night to get the win.
You got it. Evan Sidery is live up in Milwaukee getting set for game two coming up tomorrow night of Sporting News. You can find him in Forbes and more. Evan Sidery on the social media platform X. So how are you doing your downtime today in Milwaukee?
Yeah, I don't know if you've heard in the background, but there's been some geese fighting out in front of the hotel here. But outside of that, just hanging out at the hotel, enjoying some geese fight.
All right.
Exactly, yeah. Enjoying a local IPA out here and having a good day.
What is that, like local IPA, so that you're not going with the Pabst or, the Millers or anything like that up there?
I'm more of a rotating lager kind of guy, so really whatever's on tap, whatever's the best here, I just went for that.
Yeah, the beer up there, right? So a lot of Miller Genuine. Is there any Miller Genuine Draft? They still make that? I know they do the High Life, obviously, which is a staple. Is the Genuine Draft up there too?
I haven't seen it, at least in the last 24 hours or so.
Gotcha.
But I know there's like a Miller Lite tour they do for the facility up here. I actually did that before, not like today, but I did it before in the past. Actually a pretty cool tour if anyone's ever in town.
Awesome. How about Miller Lite Ice? They still make that? From the 90s?
Gosh.
Any ice beers up there?
I have not seen that.
Gotcha.
But I will be on the lookout for you, though.
All right, buddy. We'll check in later on this week, I'm sure, Evan. Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely, John. Appreciate it again. Thanks.
Whether it's audiobooks or all-time greatest hits, long live listening to your favorites. Learn more about Kisqali Ribociclib 200 milligrams at KISQALI.com and talk to your doctor to see if Kisqali is right for you.
On the Andy Mohr Automotive Group hotline, our next guest, it may be hard for Stephen Holder to back that up right now as he joins us. Great phone call from Judy.
That was, listen, it's draft season, right? So if we're talking about this in draft terms, that was a blue chip level call right
there.
Phenomenal. And she's right, by the way. I think we all know a lot of those things, but she's right to emphasize, I think, the Halliburton issue. Like, you got to have a killer instinct. And I get that this is not a new take, right? But if you're going to be a star in this league, you got to know when your team ain't got it. And you got to say, give me the damn ball. I got this. And, you know, and just get out of my way. He may get there. He may get there in this series, but he was not there and did not possess that trait last night. And it's hard to win in the playoffs if your best player doesn't display that. So anyway,
yeah, exactly.
She had a better take than I did, but I'm just confirming what she said.
And then without Giannis, the best player for the Bucks was just that and Lillard. So
yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's the thing. The Bucks got that from their top guy. The Pacers did not, and so. Pretty predictable.
8:30 tomorrow night, game number 2 for the Pacers and the Bucks in that first round series. 8 o'clock again, your coverage begins right here on 93.5 and 107.5 The Fan. So, things you learned with a short conversation you had with Colts owner Jim Irsay.
Yeah, it's always good to hear from him. I would say that the main emphasis for reaching out to him, you know, which I've done occasionally, is – you know, I get a lot of questions from fans. I'm sure you hear this too. What's going on? And is he in charge? What's, you know, who's in charge? What's he doing? What's his status? So I think I told him it would be good for you to address this, because that question is out there. Whether you and I have that question is not the point. The question's out there. And so I thought that was productive to get him to at least engage on that topic. And so, you know, what I learned from him on that in that regard is that he's not there physically. So if you didn't read the article, it's up on ESPN.com right now. If you click on the NFL tab, basically the long short of it is that he had these other issues that we're not entirely clear about. Right. So I can't speak to those, but for the things that we do know about, the most recent is he had a very major back surgery, something to do with his lower back. I would say maybe a month or two ago. And this has been a very, very difficult procedure. So he's having a lot of trouble getting around right now. So that's why you haven't seen him, and may not for a little bit. So he's not going to be with the Colts during the draft, but he's going to be patched in virtually. So he'll be in the draft room, kind of, sort of, and we'll still be able to converse with Chris Ballard and Shane Steichen and the staff. So he even said he'd get on the phone calls when they call up the draft picks to tell them they're selecting them. So he wants it to be pretty normal, and the difference being that he won't be there in person. And then finally, I would say that he emphasized August 3rd, which is when he's supposed to present Dwight Freeney for the Hall of Fame in Canton. So I'm not saying that's the next time we'll see him, but I know that's something that's very important to him. And I imagine that's circled on his calendar, to be rehabbed and ready to go at that point, if not before that.
He is Stephen Holder of ESPN and ESPN.com on the Andy Mohr Automotive Group hotline. Prior to this conversation, when was the last time that you had words with him?
I have had some back and forth text exchanges with him. I know Mike Chappell has spoken to him briefly as well, maybe a few weeks ago, but very limited conversation. And I've kind of left him alone too, right? Because I knew he was dealing with a very intense rehab and you know, and clearly even before that, he was hospitalized for quite some time. But yeah, I've had a couple of exchanges with him, but again, nothing at length and certainly not a lengthy conversation as this. So this would be the first time I've had any real conversation with him really in this entire calendar year. So it's been a long time.
Was uplifting maybe too strong of the word, but yeah. Did that conversation make you feel better about where he is compared to all the things that were going around and what we were thinking at the end of the year?
Well, certainly I would say yes, because I mean, I had some sense that he was in a decent place, you know, physically, right. He's got to recover, but just in terms of like, he's okay, I guess is what I'm saying, you know? I was told that, but I hadn't spoken to him, you know, and I think there's a difference when you actually speak to someone and you have that give and take, that back and forth. So it was productive that way. And I do think that he clearly is plugged in to what's going on. You know, he talked a lot about Anthony Richardson. He's really looking forward to that. And I think his the quote that he had, I thought was definitely, you know, telling, you know, very indicative of that, where he said, you know, he says, we've literally scratched the surface. We've just scratched the surface on what we think we can be in the Anthony Richardson era. So he was his usual self, if you think about it, right? Which is always optimistic, always thinking in grand optimistic terms. And so that part hasn't changed. And I think you'll continue to hear that from him whenever, you know, he's back in the public eye. So that sounded like Jim Irsay to me. So that was very familiar. And he also, in terms of the draft, said that I would agree with this assessment, that he said, you know, we have a lot of options and we can go a lot of different ways. And I think that really reflects their position. They're right in the middle of the first round. It's a deep draft. They don't need a quarterback. So they can kind of wait for it to come to them. I think they're in a somewhat of a position of strength, really. So he indicated that as well. So he knows what's going on and he's paying attention. And I know him and Chris Ballard have been in regular contact as well.
So speaking of Chris Ballard, and Stephen Holder joins us, met with the media, his pre-draft conversation with you guys on Friday. Normally you don't get much out of it. I'm curious how much you did take away from it. And it seemed like he was a little bit spirited compared to what we have seen at similar points in the past. Yes?
Yeah. I mean, I think there's a little bit of, shall we say, like the pressure's off a little bit, at least as the draft goes, right? I'm not talking about the season.
Right.
Like they got to win, and that is clear. But I do think there's a little bit of relief, I guess, you know, in terms of this draft. Like they can go any way they want, and there really isn't a pick where I don't think, at least for the most part, there's not too many picks they could make where there's going to be pitchforks. You know, I do think there are. Obviously, they draft an offensive lineman or something like that. There's going to be a lot of head scratching. But generally, there's probably four or five positions or, you know, 6 to 10 players they could select. And I think people would be like, all right, yeah, I get it. You know, that's a good player. You know, and that takes the pressure off of you. I mean, I think certainly they need a little more in the secondary, or at least a lot of us think they do. Whether he agrees is a different question. But I think there's a lot of expectation they do need to address the secondary, but they also could perhaps afford to do it in the second round. Like they could get a wide receiver in the first round and still feel like the second round provides them some options in the secondary. And you can get a player who is playable on opening day in the second round. They've done that many times. So anyway, that's what I took away, is like, man, I got the quarterback and he's got to perform, right? And time will tell on that. But at least for now, you got the quarterback. That weight is lifted off of your shoulders. You've got the core of your team. And for whatever they did or didn't do in free agency, they have a foundation. And really, this draft is just about just find some good players. That's all this is.
Yeah. Is belief in how you put together a winning team remains, even if it hasn't shown the results here. So I were you still surprised they haven't added anybody? And still, that may happen. Anybody veteran-wise to that secondary?
Well, I think what they have going for them is that they have still some veterans that are still out there, and they know that as you get close to the draft, those guys, they're just going to wait, particularly those veteran safeties. Let's, for example, right? Let's talk about the veteran safeties that are out there. There's a handful of them that, you know, could come in and be starting caliber players, I think. Well, typically those guys aren't going to, at this point, take a deal. They're going to wait for the dust to settle and wait for the draft. And teams aren't rushing out to make deals before the draft because they don't know what their roster is going to look like once they make their picks. So Chris Ballard can sit back and know that that's likely to be the case and that you can kind of slow play it. They've done this before. If you go back to, this is a long time ago, but and actually this was Ryan Grigson, now that I think about it, but Mike Adams, right? The safety who had a couple of Pro Bowl seasons here. I mean, Mike Adams was signed, if I recall, during the veteran minicamp in June back in like 2014. He ended up being one of the top interception men in the NFL that year. I believe went to the Pro Bowl that season. That's a transaction they made practically at the start of the offseason. At the end of the offseason program, I should say. So that's, you know, I'm not saying they can duplicate that here. I'm not saying they should wait that long. All I'm saying is, though, there are deals to be had even now and even after the draft. And I think that's kind of where they are. They're in a holding pattern. Really, the NFL is in a holding pattern at this point. So that's kind of where they're at.
So Stephen Holder of ESPN and ESPN.com, he's on the Andy Moore Automotive Group hotline. Do you have a particular lean on where you think they may go at 15 overall, if indeed they stay at 15 overall Thursday?
Look, I mean, I've done a bunch of these beat writer mock drafts, which mean absolutely nothing, okay? But I do think they give you a sense, you know, because you're talking to people that have their pulse or their finger on the pulse of what's happening in various cities. And if you don't know as a listener what I'm talking about, I mean, where it's organized where, you know, you have a reporter in various NFL cities who cover various teams, make a pick for each team. And as we've gone through them, I've done at least three of those. And in each of them, I've had Quinyon Mitchell available to me, the Toledo cornerback. By all accounts, he seems to be the top corner in this class. I think if you can get the top corner, you take him. Now, wide receiver is interesting. But here's my perspective on wide receiver is, and Chris Ballard agrees, it's a deep class. He specifically noted wide receiver being deep. I think if it's a deep class, then maybe there's more value there in the second round. I think if you can get the top player at a particular position, and a guy who physically, in Mitchell, a guy who physically, he matches what they like. I remember Chris Ballard telling me once, like, he won't even look at a cornerback under, like, 5'11". So this guy's, like, I think 6'1", long, and to boot, he's got top-end speed, 4.3 speed, legit. So he checks all the boxes. And I think he fits them physically. He fits them from a scheme perspective. And he is probably one of the elite players that'll get through that top 10 and be at their disposal at number 15. So I think he's a likely target. And I would not, however, eliminate defensive end. I think, you know, it depends on who's there. And I don't know that they're as plentiful, that position. But I still go back to the fact that they made a substantial offer to Danielle Hunter. And that has to mean something, I feel like.
Yeah, they did. I don't think I come away with them. I know what you're saying about, you know, defensively and what is needed, but man, as much as they're placing on the shoulders of Anthony Richardson, they've got to have more. Really, you never can have enough, but you got to have more. And if a guy like Brock Bowers is there, and people are going to say, well, he's a tight end, and they got a lot of tight ends, but to me, he's a weapon. And I just think they take the best offensive weapon on the board if he's there.
So I don't disagree. Just to be clear, so let me go back and clarify this part. So, for example, in the scenario I laid out in these mock situations that I've been participating in those, Bowers has been gone. I think a popular choice has been the Jets, who I think are what, number 10, 11, 12, somewhere in there. So that has been something I've seen predicted several times, Bowers to the Jets. I have no inside knowledge about that team's interest in him specifically, but I do think that makes sense, right? You know, Aaron Rodgers coming back. They've got, an impressive cast of players on offense. I get it. It makes some sense. So if he's gone, then I think, that's the scenario I'm painting you. If he's there, then I think it becomes a really intriguing conversation. I don't typically think you take a tight end that high, typically, okay? And most people would agree with that. There's a reason tight ends, just across the NFL, they're not one of the higher paid positions, because from a position positional value perspective, they're not seen that way. However, there are exceptions to everything. And if you think this guy can be, I'm just throwing this name out there, if you think he can be a Travis Kelce type player, or at least have a Travis Kelce like impact for the Colts, well, then that's a different conversation, right? So it boils down to their analysis of him. If they think this is a potentially generational tight end, go for it. Like, go for it. But he's got to be, like, on that level of, in terms of what you predict for him, because of the positional value. So it's kind of like the Quentin Nelson calculation, okay? They took a guard at number 6. Like, no one does that, right? But it's Quentin Nelson. I mean, he's probably going to be a Hall of Famer one day, right? So if you're ever going to do it, the guy has to be off the charts elite. And if they see him that way, I got no issue with that. I'm not the guy to ask, because I don't do it for a living. They do. If that's their assessment and the Colts say, this guy can be a generational player, talking about Brock Bowers, I don't care what position he plays, take him.
No, I agree. I can, and I just call him a weapon. And that's what Anthony Richardson needs, weapons.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that has to be a part of the conversation. So sure. I don't mean to, like, gloss over that. Because I do think the success of this team is clearly linked to the quarterback, right? It's true for every team, but certainly right now, the position they're in, they got to learn about this guy, and the way to learn about him is to give him the most tools possible. At the same time, it all works together, right? If your defense is better and gets off the field and gives up a few less, third and eights, Anthony Richardson's going to have the ball more. So, it should all work together. But I do understand the philosophy, help your young quarterback. It's kind of like I used the Kelce example earlier. I really think that him and Mahomes, like, is that a chicken or the egg, right? I mean, who's lifting who? I mean, I think it's probably Mahomes, but at the same time, right? I mean, there's a reason he's been able to withstand Mahomes, and the Chiefs have been able to withstand the departure of some of the, some of their great offensive talent. And frankly, it's because Kelce has held it together for them. And also, their quarterback is freaking fantastic. But you need more than that sometimes.
So Chris Ballard is making fun of the Marvin Harrison Jr. trade-up conversations?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the interview on, what was he on, Dan Patrick, I believe, last week?
Yeah, I think so.
Is that what you're referring to?
Yes, exactly. Yes.
Yeah, I think he did make a little joke about it, but I also think he gave an actual really honest answer. And I was actually refreshing. It was refreshing to hear it. He basically said, yeah, we can't pull that off. He just said, you know, going from number 15 to, for argument's sake, number 4, he's like, yeah, like how? And really that's an honest response. And I mean, can you imagine what it would take? It would take, I don't know, 3 first round picks. I don't know. I mean, it would be a mind blowing offer. I'm not kidding. It would be mind blowing. And I think the example is the Trey Lance trade, like the first trade, not the one where the 49ers got rid of him. When the 49ers made that trade with, was it Miami? I think
it was. Yes.
Yeah. Prior to drafting Trey Lance, they went from, oh man, I didn't mean to make myself do a pop quiz here. I think they went from number 6 to number 3, or maybe it was more. It was maybe like 8 or 9 to number 3. It was a haul. I mean, an all-time haul in terms of what they got back in that trade. And that was not going nearly as far as it would take for the Colts to go up and get a guy like Marvin Harrison. Now, if he falls or something, and I don't know what scenario that would be, but, you know, I don't know. Maybe somebody's got a Dunze ranked ahead of him. I don't know. And let's say he falls. Well, then maybe it gets easier if he's a couple spots lower. The way that would happen, the scenario for that to happen, I guess, would be there would have to be a bigger run on quarterbacks than we anticipate. And it only takes one team, right, if they fall in love with a quarterback. You know, we'll see what happens, I guess. But yeah, Chris Ballard is generally right on that. If it goes according to the consensus thinking, they're not going to be within range to get Marvin Harrison Jr. without just an astronomical or paying an astronomical price, which I don't think they're willing to pay.
Oh, it's so fun to talk about, though.
It was.
Yeah.
It is. Listen, I'm here for it.
Like, I did see where Chris also kind of made reference to, and maybe not you, I'm sure mine and others, offensive line barbs going back a couple of years and how inaccurate that was. So I did hear him make reference to that. He digs doing those little victory laps at times, doesn't he? That's weird.
Yeah, I mean, he's not necessarily pissed as much as he's just kind of like sticking his finger
sticking it to us.
And I think that, first of all, he's right. Okay, what he said is, you know, you guys are on my case about the offensive line after 2022. Yes, because we saw Matt Ryan get treated like a piñata. Okay, yes, we were on your case. They were awful. They were dreadful. They were one of the worst offensive lines in football. However, he is right when he says, you know, we gave them the space to work through that and got a new offensive line coach and better scheme, and voila, look what happened, right? Okay, that is true. But it was pointed out to me by one of my colleagues in reaction to that statement. What he did not say is that those guys had played at an elite level before. Here, where we're talking about the secondary, I would not say that the secondary has been elite. They haven't proven anything outside of Blackman and Kenny Moore. Those guys don't have a track record. So that's the problem. And that is the difference. It's one thing to bank on Quentin Nelson and Ryan Kelly and Braden Smith. I'm banking on those guys. That's why they get paid $20 million a year in some cases, right? Like Quentin Nelson. So you have to bank on that. This is a little different. You're banking on youth and inexperience and a lack of a track record. So I don't think that's apples to apples when he pushed back on that assertion that this is just like the criticism of the offensive line. That is a key difference.
I thought that just maybe he was remembering how I wanted to turn Quentin Nelson into a left tackle. Maybe that was it.
That was also a fun conversation. Hey, listen. I don't think it was an unwarranted conversation.
Sure.
I personally wouldn't have done it. And so I agree with how they handled it. But I think when you talk about what you're paying them, yeah, that's fine. That is a perfectly reasonable conversation to have. So I was fine with it.
I want to see him do the big victory lap one of these days, not these little bitty ones. So let's.
Well, listen, he's going to have to win some more games to do it, and we will see.
Always a pleasure, buddy. I appreciate you. We'll do it again next week and see how things go down over the draft weekend. Thank you.
All right. Looking forward to it.
So Stephen Holder of ESPN and ESPN.com.
Whether it's audiobooks or all-time greatest hits, long live listening to your favorites. Learn more about Kisqali Ribociclib 200 milligrams at KISQALI.com and talk to your doctor to see if Kisqali is right for you.